Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to John McWhorter of Columbia University about his book, The Language Hoax. In the book, subtitled Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language, he examines the claim that language shapes cognition, the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. He contends that, in fact, the influence of language on how we think is marginal, and the idea that speakers of different languages see the world differently is a major exaggeration. In this interview, we discuss why this is the case, and what is attractive for people about the idea that each language comes equipped with its own worldview. We talk about the history of that idea and some of its political significance, and we consider how the discipline of academic linguistics has developed and reacted to the idea in the past decades. I'm delighted to welcome John McWhorter to talk about his new book, The Language Hoax, in which he challenges the view that the language we speak significantly influences the way we think. John, what prompted you to write this book?
I wrote this book because it is a very popular idea, especially among people who are interested in language or anthropology and with the media as well, that the language you speak shapes the way that you perceive the world. And I think that for a lot of people, there's an appeal in thinking that if there are, say, 6,000 different languages in the world, there's 6,000 different pairs of glasses that we can look at. And I think the idea also has appeal because it's a very handy way for privileged Westerners such as us to understand, to show that we understand that particularly indigenous people are our cognitive equals. It gives us, I think, a justifiable sense of enlightenment and I think even goodness to think, yes, the tribesmen might be seeing colors differently than we do. The tribesmen might be seeing sources of evidence in more detail than we do. So all human brains are equal. The idea has great appeal. And the problem is that as appealing as it is, like many things that we wish were true, it really hasn't been shown to be true by the psychologists who are actually working on that way of looking at language and thought. So does language have an effect on thought? Yes, a tiny, eensy, weensy bit. But the idea that if you speak language X, then you're thinking in a way that corresponds to language X, and by extension, that the culture connected with the language is encoded in how the language works, it just doesn't hold up. And so it's shoddy science, and I also discuss in the book how it also ends up making us condescend to the very people who we're trying to elevate in looking at languages in this way. So I thought it was time for there to be a go-to argument from the other side. And some of these issues are not perfectly cut and dried. I can't be claiming to be, you know, Moses off of the Mount. But in general, if you're trying to address the language and thought hypothesis, if you're interested in Whorfianism, then what you find is a great many books that are written as if it is an accepted fact or close to it. And I thought there needs to be at least one book showing that there's another way of looking at it, especially because I think if you talk to most linguists in particular, they would agree with me or at least see that I have a lot of decent points. I'm not saying anything particularly unique. I'm just broadcasting what I think a lot of common consensus is, because I think that there is a certain I socio-political incorrectness about dwelling too much on what doesn't work about the language and thought hypothesis, and I understand that, but I think we need to go for the empirical, we need to go for truth, especially because, as I said, looking at the language and thought hypothesis in the real way, looking at what the data really say, and especially what they don't, I think ultimately creates a more humanistic way and a more egalitarian way of looking at the world's peoples than the standard languages thought popular cocktail party view.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned the idea of there being a popular view and that linguists in particular are quite skeptical about that view. It's my impression from the way you describe the literature in the book that you think the scientific or the more scientific end of the literature is reasonably balanced, but it's been distorted increasingly in the retelling and popularization. Is that a fair assessment?
That is very much true. And so it's very important to stress here that countless experiments have shown that a language can affect thought in tiny but interesting ways. And so, for example, in Russian, there's no one word for blue. There's a separate word for dark blue and a separate word for light blue. And it turns out that Russians are a tiny bit faster at distinguishing where dark blue shades off into light blue, exactly 124 milliseconds on the average faster. And the way the experiment has been constructed by Lara Boroditsky, who's a psychologist now at the University of San Diego, it's clear that it's the language. It certainly has nothing to do with culture. There's nothing about being Russian that makes you perceive blue in a different way. It's the language that makes you a little bit quicker at that, just a little. And there are experiments like that with all sorts of languages. The problem is that it makes it out into the newspapers and the magazines and today the blog posts, etc., as if it means that a Russian person is walking around perceiving blue in a more popping way than we are. And that extends to all sorts of other differences between languages where you could say that, wow, those people are seeing X completely differently from us, and it's because of their language. And no psychological experiment has ever shown any difference of that magnitude. And what it comes down to is, are we talking about world views? None of those experiments have ever shown anything that we would call a worldview.
As you allude to in your introductory discussion, this idea has a, you know, obviously has a certain appeal, particularly as something that people can grasp onto and talk about as a sort of factoid about the way that things are supposed to be. The idea that the whole Sapir-Whorf hypothesis has this quite interesting history in terms of the kinds of perhaps rather unexpected political purposes that it's been associated with. You talk about some of the sort of less palatable consequences of that idea. I mean, how has that played out?
Well, the original idea of what is often called Whorfianism was to show that the Hopi Native Americans are more sophisticated in thought than the typical even educated person thought back in the 30s. And so, certainly the whole language of thought idea arose with exactly what I think gives it appeal today, which is that it showed Westerners that there's no such thing as a primitive person. And so Whorf's idea was that the Hopi language doesn't have any markers of tense, no ways of indicating time, and that meant that the Hopi see time as cyclical. And for Whorf, that was neat. That was actually in many ways better than our so-called Western way of seeing time as a matter of being the past and the present and the future. Now, that's a really neat idea. I was exposed to that idea when I was in college. You can't help but love it. Now, as it happens, for one thing, it's not true about Hopi. Whorf was a brilliant man, but he wasn't really a linguist, and there was only so much known about Hopi at the time, and his facts were wrong. Hopi has, you know, tense just like European languages do. There is a different Hopi cultural way of looking at things, certainly, and I don't deny that. But the idea that their language is making them see the world in a certain way, or even, and this is what I think many people would prefer when they hear about the problems with this stuff, or even the idea that it's a holistic relationship, it's the language and the culture and the culture and the language, it just doesn't work. That's not what Hopi is like at all. But in the meantime, what you get when you really try to apply Whorfianism consistently, is that you find that for everything that's cool in some language, like, for example, Hopi supposedly not having any tense, you'll find that there are other things in languages where if you're going to link that thing in the language with thought, it's not cool. And that sort of thing, quite frankly, gets swept under the rug by people who study this sort of thing. And that's what I mean by all of this being shoddy science. And so a quick example is Chinese. Chinese is a language where if you learn it from a European language, the overriding impression is how much less they have to say in a sentence, how much gets left to context. And one of those things is counterfactuality, hypotheticality. You don't have to do as many of the would haves and the heads and if he might have. A lot of that gets left to context and they communicate just fine. But if you do the Whorfianism routine, then if you look at Chinese, you think, that must mean that the Chinese aren't as sensitive to the counterfactual and the hypothetical, and let's admit it, that's saying that the Chinese really aren't as bright. Now, a credentialed psychologist tried just that. He had no malice in his intention, but back in the early 80s, he did some experiments that seemed to show that to speak Chinese was to be somewhat less sensitive to the counterfactual and the hypothetical. And you know, there was a long trail over the next 25 years of attempts to refute that man's work, because all of a sudden, here's a Whorfian idea that isn't appealing. But the thing is, there are all sorts of things in languages where you could draw conclusions that were negative like that. If we don't want to accept the idea that Chinese creates a worldview in its speakers because of its relative lack of necessity of counterfactuals, then we can't have the cool things either. What it really is that the way language affects thought can't be accepted as a worldview. If you don't want the Chinese worldview to be a dim one, then you can't have, for example, the Russian worldview being one where Picasso's Blue Period paintings pop more than they do for people who speak English. It all just comes out as a wash.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me very interesting the way in which that idea has sort of historically been motivated in that sense. It's sort of almost surprising, encouraging, but surprising that this idea of difference was associated sort of in the early decades of the 20th century in the Whorfian tradition with the idea that so-called primitive cultures were actually going to be superior.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, of course, it could equally be used under other political currents of thought.
Exactly.
To argue the converse.
Exactly. Yeah, it really is exactly that. And really, you can make good arguments either way if you're going to call it worldview, because language does affect thought a tiny bit. But if you're going to look at something about a language of an indigenous group and think, well, that couldn't possibly be a matter of their thought because it's something that we don't want to think about, then if that's not a worldview, then none of the cool things are either. And I thought that something like that needed to be shared in my book. That's a lot of why I wrote The Language Hoax, because what a lot of it comes down to when you talk about this sort of thing with people who are big fans of Whorfianism is, who's to say what a worldview is? So, okay, 124 milliseconds is the average difference in a Russian speed at detecting when dark blue becomes light blue. Who are we to say that that isn't a worldview? And yes, there's a where do you draw the line issue there. And I think it needs to be said, where you draw the line as to where it's a worldview is wherever you'd want to draw it if the trait weren't cool. And therefore, what you end up seeing is something that is really neat in psychology. I tell my students about the Whorfian experiments all the time and how interesting it is that there are these tiny effects. But it cannot be a matter of trying to sell the world on the idea that languages are all giving us our own different acid trips, for the simple reason that they aren't.
It does seem as though some of the dispute between the two sides of this debate centers around this question of what is, as you say, a sufficiently profound difference to constitute, well, maybe a worldview, although to be interesting
exactly.
In some sense. Is it fair to say there's not really any knockdown evidence for anything that we can look at and interpret as a really substantial difference in our outlook?
Nothing like that has ever been shown. Now, what has been shown is that culture can be reflected in language. And there are times when people look at stark cultural differences and tell us that what's going on is that it's the language that's making people think that way. But that's a rather backwards way of thinking of it. And so the classic experiment, and this is one that Whorfian fans often bring out, is that there are people in Australia who, instead of saying that something is in front of them or in back of them, will always say that something is north or south. And, of course, the directions don't change. And so if they're standing and facing north and there's something in front of them, they'll say that it's north of them. Turn that person around. They don't say that the thing is in back of them. They say it's north of them. Now, that is one of the most fiercely interesting things I think most of us have ever heard. You would never think that human beings would process life that way. Now, the people who have studied this sort of culture want us to think that we're supposed to look at that and think their language is making them do that. And so their language has these terms for north and south instead of front and back, and so the language makes them think that way. No, it's that their culture and their environment have created words in their language that correspond to something that they need. Those people, as might not surprise you, live on very flat land. They need to keep north and south and west and east in mind in a way that you and I don't. There is no documented group that does that where there are more landmarks, and those very same people, once they end up living in cities, for better or for worse, very quickly start to let the north, south, and the west and the east go. So there are differences that you see that some Whorfians will say prove that the language creates the worldview, but I think most of us would look at these groups. I think often, I hate to put it this way, but I think many children would look at these situations and say, isn't it interesting how the culture is different? And of course, because we communicate with words and grammar, the language will correspond to aspects of the culture. That's something quite different from something like Russian, where the idea is that in the language there happens to, by chance, be this difference between dark and light blue, and so therefore it really is the language that's creating the difference. And in that case, we get back to, well, what is a worldview, and we measure it by thinking about whether or not we want the Chinese to be portrayed as dumb because their language is more telegraphic than Russian or a great many others.
Sure. I mean, going back to the coordinate systems, as I read it, the claim of that literature, or the, if you like, most interesting claim, the one that goes furthest towards the idea of a worldview, is the idea that people with the north, south, east, west kinds of systems do dead reckoning even when circumstances don't call for it. So they have to track whether objects are north or south of each other rather than just to the left or to the right.
Exactly.
That's not something that you could say is really constitutive of a worldview. What I wondered really was whether our inability to find things that were constitutive of a worldview is just because that concept is itself really quite nebulous and we don't know what we're looking for a lot of the time.
Well, you know, I think that in terms of what most people are looking for in terms of a worldview, the coordinate issue would be one of them. The idea being that these are people who walk around with a sense of the compass at all times. I right now am sitting in a basement and I can intellectually think to myself, given that the Hudson River is over there, I think now I know what north is. I just worked that out. But that is not something that I keep in my mind. Whereas there are people who would have no trouble with that whatsoever. You could take them, make them dizzy, put them, you know, wherever in this whole house. That's a worldview. And so I think there are people who have interestingly differing worldviews. That's what we call anthropology. The question is whether those views are, to any significant extent, created by how your verbs work, how your prepositions work, how your language works. And I think that when it comes to how languages are interesting, there are so many different ways that a language can be fascinating. We don't need this fragile construct that language is interesting because it corresponds to something specific about people's cultures. There's just so much more.
So going back to the question of how this idea interfaces with linguistics, you discuss also the sort of conceptual opposition of Whorfianism to the universalism of Chomskyan linguistics. Do you feel that's something that's been important in how the idea has been received and how it's developed in that
discipline? Definitely. That is a lot of it culturally. And as with many culturally in terms of linguistic culture among linguists, and as with many cultural things, I don't think this is felt explicitly, but Noam Chomsky basically revolutionized linguistics starting in the mid-60s with his idea that human beings have an inborn syntax, and that despite how different languages seem all over the world, all of them are variations on a single inborn pattern. What differs is the words, and you fiddle with some dials and switches, but basically we're all speaking the same language with different word shapes. And that theory is put forth with a very dense jargon, and as the decades pass, the mechanism is ever more abstractly related to anything that even most intelligent or enlightened or even learned people would think of as language at all. And so, there's a challenge in knowing what those people are talking about. You can't just open up one of their articles and read it on the beach. It all looks kind of mathy. And so, there is a feeling among many linguists that that way of looking at things is quite detached from anything that language is. And there's also a certain amount of resentment because one can feel from some adherents of that school that there's a sense that if you don't understand that way of looking at things, then you're not as bright as the people in Chomskyan crowd. And some of them have been known to say that what they're doing is the only question about language that any intelligent person would want to ask. If you're looking at anything else, how language changes or how language relates to cognition in general, none of that is genuinely linguistics. That's the culture that there's been. It's all kind of analogous to the serialists in classical music back in the day. Right down to that there aren't really that many of these people, but boy, is there a certain cultural cachet, there's a certain glamour. Noam Chomsky's probably got an IQ of 500 and is a very good arguer, and many of his acolytes are the same. So there is a kind of resentment that many people have of that Chomskyan paradigm. And so Whorfianism has a certain appeal because it's all about language as spoken by actual people and connected to cultures. It seems like what language really ought to be, it's more intuitive, it's more humanistic, it's more interdisciplinary. And so I think for many, the idea is one way that you show that you're somebody who is interested in language rather than this rather algebraic and sometimes vaguely hostile-seeming universal grammar syntax paradigm is that you're into Whorfianism, which is about how your grammar is not just some abstract clot of features in your brain that don't seem to have anything to do with how we express ourselves. Instead, it's culture. It is the things that make human beings human. It's the sorts of things that have to do with sunny skies and popping blues and sources of evidence, etc. And so, the idea is either you're one of these Chomskyans, or certainly you're going to be a Whorfianism and understand that language is about what the people who speak them. But, you know, you can understand that language is about the people who speak it without being someone who falls for the idea that the way a grammar is put together corresponds with the way people are seeing the world. And, you know, I would be the first person to jump in with celebrating that as being true if it were, but it just isn't. If we want to be scientific, the Chomskyans are certainly scientific. If the rest of us are going to be scientific, then we have to look at how the world really is. And so that's another aspect of the language hoax that I think is important. You can understand that language and culture are connected, which they certainly are, without thinking that they're connected in the way that Benjamin Lee Whorf, quite well-intentioned but misguided, taught us to starting back in the 30s.
I wondered where you stood on the work by to the likes of Evans and Levinson about the idea of understanding, as I read it, understanding universal or universal properties, shared properties, through exploring the differences rather than looking for similarities, which they argue are not all that easy to come by.
Right, right. It's certainly worth trying to find universals of language in some sense, because it seems rather evident at this point that human beings are specified in some way to learn language. Now, the Chomskyan's idea is that what we're genetically specified for is something extremely difficult to conceive of as a product of natural selection as a component of what we know of human psychology. However, it would be quite interesting to find out what's actually up there. One sense is that it would be quite general, given how very different languages are. One sense is that it would be very deeply tied up with other aspects of cognition. But certainly, one must look for the universals. Worfianism is about looking at the differences. And I think that most people who come from linguistics from the outside find those differences more interesting than the universals themselves. And as I said, that's partly because if you know anything about linguistics as a science, then the universals are often exposed to you as the rather forbidding and I think on the ropes Chomskyan paradigm. But then also, I think if you're interested in languages and you have a sense of how much they vary, you can see that the universals are going to be pretty broad. And so, yeah, sensitivity to time, maybe past, maybe future. But, you know, there are languages that don't have tense. Yes, there's probably going to be some innate sensitivity to the difference between what we call a noun and a verb. Maybe the other stuff, however, are things that our minds can just handle that have evolved from those noun and verb originals, but that we're not specified for. After all, we can read, we can drive, we're not genetically specified for those things. Much of language might fall under that rubric as well. So we can see, very interesting to find the universals. Worfianism, though, is exactly what appeals to people because it takes us away from that.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that something linguistics teaches us is that it's very difficult to trace the relation between some kind of surface feature manifest in language and any kind of cognitive process underpinning it. So by the same token, as indeed you made clear in your discussion of various examples, it's quite difficult to tell anything more than a just-so story about how a particular manifestation in language ought to be a signal of a particular cognitive predisposition.
Oh, yeah, this is definitely true. The sexy thing about language for many people, including me, is that the pathway between what comes out of our mouths and what the cognitive underpinning is often so indirect. Language is messy because it has evolved, or I often like to say morphed, because evolved makes it sound like it's going in a particular direction. It has morphed over millennia and millennia in various ways. The human brain, especially when it's young, can process an awesome amount of randomness, irregularity, and just plain complexity. And so languages just get jangled along, because by the time we figure out that languages make so little sense, we're too old to break the habit. And so language is fascinating in that way. However, that indirect line between what we're saying and what's going on underneath is indeed something that makes Worfianism a challenge. For one thing, because it's easy to think that the line between what we say and what we're thinking is more direct than it could possibly be, and that leads us to all sorts of unsavory conclusions, which many people who didn't call themselves Worfians, because Worf didn't exist, actually fell into in the past. It's interesting. Today, newspaper journalist, or frankly, even a linguist or anthropologist who's committed to preserving languages, will confidently say, this language expresses the worldview of its people, and if the language dies, for example, then a view on the world is gone. Whereas 150 years ago, you could have, for some reason, they tended to be Germans, saying things about how a language and the intellectual development of a people are certainly inextricably tied together, and therefore it was said by some that Chinese must be evidence of some earlier stage of human development because it doesn't have the prefixes and the suffixes and the lists of those sorts of things that European languages do. Those people would say those sorts of things. We look at it now, it's in German, we chuckle, we figure they had three names and mustaches and they didn't have electricity. They didn't know any better, you know, the world was still at war, etc. Whereas today we think it's different if an anthropologist says it because the anthropologist means good things. But the problem is, as I've said, that there are bad things that you could come up with using the exact same paradigm. To say it today is really no different from somebody von something saying it in 1850 with different intent. What languages show is that fundamentally all people think alike.
Yeah. I mean, a sort of canonical example of that malleability of the way we perceive these differences is that taking a language like Chinese, it seems like we could say on the one hand, because syntactic relations are not clearly marked in it, it must reflect a more primitive status of language development, or we could say on the other hand, because syntactic relations are not clearly Mark, the people who speak the language must be able to perform sublime feats of inference in order to understand the sentences. So presumably it does depend how you perceive things. And you illustrate this by discussing English as from the outside, as it were, of the kinds of conclusions we could draw about our own language if we were minded to reason in that way.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, because there is a kind of feint that Worfians sometimes do, which is to say that context, if a language relies a lot on context, then that itself is a kind of complexity as well. But besides a certain circularity that you find in ideas like that, it becomes hard to hold it up when you see something like Keith Chen, who is an economist at Yale, very bright, great, great person, but he had a TED Talk and a paper, both of them have gone viral, where he says that because Chinese does not have what we would call a future tense, it's not having a future tense makes its speakers think about the future more and therefore save money. Mind you, what I'm saying is that Chinese doesn't have a future, and that therefore that makes its speakers think more about it, because they have to, because they don't have the reinforcement from the language. And so he tries to make a correlation between whether languages have explicit ways of marking the future and the savings rates that these countries have had. And as I show in the book, as neat as that experiment is, it just falls apart. There is no correlation between whether or not a language has a way of saying will, as in I will do something, and its savings rates. And one way that we can really viscerally understand how off the Worfian view is by trying to imagine it applied to us. Let's turn the microscope around. What is the worldview from English? And it's surprising how few people have addressed it. It's been addressed here and there, particularly by Anna Wiersbitzka, who has looked at things that happened in English over roughly the past 500 years and tried to tie them to aspects of England becoming a world empire and what it meant to be an English person as it developed a sense of nationhood, etc. But really, in the grand view, let's imagine what's the worldview, and let's imagine how many different sorts of people speak English. And so we can imagine, say, Mahatma Gandhi and Patricia Rutledge and Paul Hogan and me and you. Now, all of us speak English. What's the worldview from that perspective? Let's bring in Winston Churchill, and let's bring in somebody from New Zealand, and let's bring in somebody from Singapore. All these people are speaking native English. What's the worldview? And the first thing we think is that certainly the worldviews of these people are indicated by the various cultures that they grew up in. If there's something about the language that we all speak that illustrates some sort of worldview, given how different all these people are, it would have to be such a thin business. Whatever that worldview is not something, let's face it, that any of us would find terribly interesting. And even if we don't spread it all around the world, within my own country, I can think, okay, there's me. There is Mary Tyler Moore, the television star. There is Barack Obama. And then there is Melissa McCarthy, the movie star. See, I'm picking various people who are, you know, just American people. What is the worldview that we have in common? Now, of course, we're American, but what is it that's coming from English verbs or the way English splits various things in the world up in terms of lexicon? And the idea, frankly, seems absurd. And I think that we need to think about the same thing when we look at a Native American language, or if we look at Korean, or if we're trying to say something about an Australian Aboriginal language, where suddenly we think that their language must encapsulate a worldview. Is it that languages encapsulate worldviews when they're smaller? Because that doesn't make any sense at all. Obviously, culture is what distinguishes people, not the way their languages are put together, therefore creating a cultural outlook.
I suppose the original claim of Wolf's analysis of Native American languages amounted to the claim that even this very disparate group of English speakers actually have quite a similar worldview, because the other worldview exhibited by Hopi speakers say is so exotic and unimaginable to us as to be ungraspable, but there doesn't seem to be any very compelling evidence for that.
It's quite hopeless, and hopeless, and it's interesting. There are things people have said about English that are taken as implying some sort of worldview, such as that in English we say, I like apples. In many languages, it would be more likely to say, apples please to me. English is a language that's very agentive, as you might put it. It's you doing things to something else, or it's you and then there's the something else just slammed together. And so I am cold. So my state of being is in a cold state. In many languages, it's it colds to me. And so many people are tempted to imagine that in other languages, there's a sense that things are being done to you, but to speak English is to imagine yourself out there with a rapier doing things to the world. But the problem is that English only became that way because, and this is not in the book, but English only became that way because Vikings, when they started invading, learned Old English imperfectly and simplified it. And so Old English was full of the it colds me sorts of expressions, as any good Germanic language tends to be. Modern English has much less of that sort of thing because basically Vikings came and screwed it up. So you and I, in a sense, are speaking bad Old English. So it wasn't because of England taking over the world with a big club and therefore starting to talk more agentively. It was an accident. It had to do with some guys who came in taking over themselves and speaking the language badly and turning something along the lines of apples please to me into I like apples. And so you look at these sorts of things and you see these surface possible correspondences, and once again we get to the fact that the trip between cognition and the surface is a highly fraught one, and there are all sorts of reasons why you put something in one way even if you thought of it in another. And the fact is that the idea that what you say reflects what you're like just never holds up when we look at a global view. And that's one thing about my book that I think is important, which is that most Whorfian experiments and views necessarily look at maybe two languages at a time, maybe four. It's necessary because if you're doing a sophisticated psychological experiment, you can't do 25 different languages. But to be the kind of linguist who happens to have occasion to look at grammars all over the world, and there are ones who do that who know a whole lot more than I do, but the kind of work that I've done does mean that I have to walk around with grammatical sketches of a great many languages in my head. To look at languages in a worldwide sense makes it clearer how arbitrary the connection between what a language is like and what a people is like are. It's very easy to see these connections if you're looking at, say, two groups, or especially if you're looking at one. It becomes clearer that we can't see things that way when you think of language globally and you think of how all 6,000 of them vary and how that doesn't really correlate meaningfully with how those 6,000 different cultures are related. So that's another part of the language hoax. It's a book written by a language geek rather than a psychologist. And I think both views are important.
Yes, indeed. I would like to cut back, if I may, and ask a little bit more about Keith Chen's work, because mm-hmm. you discussed it in some detail. One thing I was very interested from a sort of social anthropological perspective as to how linguists collectively reacted to the kinds of ideas that he was promoting. I wondered if you'd followed that and formed a view on it.
Oh, yeah. He ran up against something that any of us would run up against if we were rooting around in a field that wasn't our own. And, I mean, he couldn't help it. He looked through grammars, and one does that. A linguist can get messed up doing this. I've gotten messed up doing this, which is that grammars are written in different ways. Grammars, linguistic grammatical descriptions are written for different audiences. And it's easy to get tripped up. And so, for example, in Russian, there is no future. And you can look in a book And it'll tell you, well, here's how to do the future. But what they mean is, here's what you say in Russian if you're trying to express what English expresses with the future tense, with the I will. That's a very subtle business to fully understand that. And to really fully understand it, you have to be a Slavicist, which I'm not. But I can sometimes badly play one on TV because I've mucked around with a lot of Slavic languages here and there. And I happen to teach in a department where there are many actual Slavicists, and so I have people I can talk to about it. And the fact of the matter is that there isn't really any future per se in the typical Slavic language. And with Chen's work, what it comes down to is quite simply this. The Slavic languages in the future, they all, almost all of them work the same way. There is no real future that we could speak of. It's easy to say that there is if you look in a book. And so Chen has a problem first with that. And it's not that he's incompetent. It's that it's very hard to smoke this sort of thing out if you don't happen to be a linguist. I don't know how he could have done any different, but unfortunately it's a mistake that he almost couldn't help making. But if you look at his chart of the world languages, if you look at his chart of how languages correlate with savings rates, very simply, the Slavic languages are all over the place. Now, that makes no sense if the Slavic languages all do the future. Most of them, there's one exception, but most of them do the future in exactly the same way. The savings rates should be exactly the same or at least close, and they're not. The reason that Chen didn't know that was a mistake is because you have to know what a Slavic grammar is telling you about whether or not there's an actual future. And so once his work came out, the Slavic is the thing that I'm mentioning because I think it's easiest to explain, but there are other dicey things that he has to say about whether a language has a future and whether it doesn't. So it's a very clever notion. It's also highly counterintuitive, which makes you suspicious, and it ends up just not working.
I was particularly interested in the way people found it really counterintuitive. I'm inclined to agree, and there are definitely good arguments against the methodology, both on the way it was coded on and the possibility of chance capitalization and the stats and so on. But what struck me first was that a lot of people, many of whom really aren't at all committed Chomskyans in any real sense, were extremely skeptical about the idea right from the outset. Just the very notion that this could be the case seemed beyond the pale.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there are two typical linguist perspectives on this kind of thing. I think that if you're somebody who specializes in writing detailed grammatical descriptions of little known languages, it becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly that all of this muck that you were making your way through could not possibly be seen as corresponding to the way a group of people think. So much of it is clearly just how a language has morphed over time and what the human brain can awesomely process. But I think that there is another kind of linguist, and this gets into a whole different issue that I've been thinking about lately, another kind of linguist who's not only writing these grammatical descriptions but is committed to saving the languages. And if you're committed to saving the languages and saving the cultures from disappearance, then the idea that all of this muck that you're describing is cultural becomes appealing because it is a very handy argument to make outside of linguistics as to why you would want this language and this culture to survive. And so I've seen some linguists who know their languages very deeply. They know all of this arbitrariness, but they'll say that I think these things are cultural, and I think part of what leads them to favor that view is that they are seeking an argument for keeping this thing from disappearing. So there are two different perspectives that I think one can have. Now, in terms of Chen, the counterintuitiveness just comes from the idea that something that isn't there it makes you think about it more. And I think most linguists in general would listen to that and be relatively skeptical. Not all, but most. And then you end up looking at the data and finding, as you expected, that the data didn't work. But linguists differ in terms of their basic orientation towards Whorfianism, I think, mostly in terms of how involved they are in preservation efforts. In my experience, the ones who are not will tell you, especially after a glass of wine, that the Whorfian idea just doesn't work. other ones are more interested in seeing if it does, or more committed in showing that it does, because for them it's part of arguing for why languages should not disappear.
So going forward, do you feel these kinds of popular misapprehensions about the extent of Whorfianism are going to die down as more progress is made in linguistic understanding, or do you feel that we're stuck with them for the foreseeable future?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that, whether people are going to stop thinking this way. You know, on the fly, I would have to say no. I expect that Whorfianism will continue to be popular, and in a way, for a good reason, which is that I think that it's part of being an enlightened Westerner today to understand that the world's peoples are all equal, that there's no such thing as a quote-unquote primitive native. And I think that there's even a certain self-denigration that we think of as a badge of sophistication, the idea that we Westerners are quote-unquote so white, for example. That expression would have had no currency 40 years ago among people like you and me. And notice I'm saying it as a black American person, but I'm speaking from a certain first world overeducated culture. Oh, that's so white. That's a very modern and enlightened way of thinking. Whorfianism plays right into that because it gives us a way of seeing that the other is our equal and maybe even our superior. That impulse in itself is a damn sight better than the way people like you and me would have thought of the world's other people 100 years ago. And so, no, I think that there will always be a certain appeal. I wouldn't say there's a direct line between some previous scenes in my life in the language hoax, but I found over the past 10 years that when I have expressed my views about Whorfianism being oversold, there's a certain kind of person who gets almost angry. And that certain kind of person is not usually a linguist, but I can see that the idea that language is not people's culture, that their culture is their culture, that that's not why you're supposed to be interested in their language, that offends many people. For them, the idea that the language is a window on their non-Western way of looking at the world is precious. And I think that it's precious because we all consider it precious not to look down on the less fortunate or people who do not live in the world of tall buildings and psychoanalysis, etc. And so, no, I think Whorfianism is going to continue to have a certain narcotic appeal, popular Whorfianism, as I call it in the book. But I think that there should be a take-home book-length argument for those who are interested from the other side, because Whorfianism is supposed to be a scientific endeavor, and it's also supposed to be a humanistic endeavor, and I think that we can see the world's peoples through egalitarian eyes without subscribing to the Whorfian view, and I try to get that across in the book, too.
I'm glad you brought this up, because I did really want to ask how this issue chimed with your broader view on race and its politics, and how it related to your, saw it as relating to your work on those topics.
None, really. Although, if you ask me, and I'm going by the seat of my pants again, there are two me's: the person who writes about race and the person who writes about language, and they're just completely different tracks in my brain. But Whorfianism has irritated me sometimes because there's a certain unintentioned condescension in it. Unintentioned, but it's there. And as a black American person, I'm naturally highly sensitized to that. And there are times when we are treating people like the toddler who we clap for when she doesn't spill her food. And I know that that sort of condescension is not intentional, but for example, I remember once listening to a very good linguist talking about a Native American language that happens to have some prefixes that correspond to food preparation and touching and chewing. Now, all languages have ways of indicating those things. Here's a language where they happen to be prefixes. And this linguist was saying that, in passing, this linguist said that these prefixes and suffixes were cultural, that this indicated that this culture places a particular value on food. And then a story was told about a little boy enjoying his popsicle. And, you know, an actual coup went up in the classroom. Not at the boy in the popsicle, but when this linguist actually said the word cultural. There was actually, I heard a bunch of people of different ages and genders all go, ooh. And I remember thinking, why in the world are we applauding that this sophisticated group of human beings liked food and liked sucking on popsicles? Why is that so special? And I thought, okay, yeah, we're showing that we understand that they're human. We're showing that we understand that they're not primitives. We're showing that they could be gourmets just like us. But really, there are higher achievements that we can celebrate in people than the fact that they know how to mix seeds and substances, and they like eating them, and they like sucking on things. And so it bothered me a little in the same way, I suppose, as it bothers me in this country when sometimes somebody who is seen as what we might call diverse is celebrated basically for just showing up or being present rather than for the caliber of what they do. I haven't thought about that much until right now, but yeah, there a bee gets in my bonnet about that kind of thing. But mostly with the language hoax, it was about just my sense that languages are being misrepresented for egalitarian reasons that aren't necessary, because you can look at the languages themselves and see that no matter what a culture is like, no matter what a people are like, those languages are showing the same mental operations happening in all of us.
Yep. I think that seems like a very inspiring and clear note on which to bring it to an end. But I would like also to ask, beyond writing this book, having placed these arguments on the record in this very readable and accessible format, do you feel this is a battle that you want to continue to engage in, the public perception of this issue, or do your professional priorities lie elsewhere?
What an interesting question. I think that one upshot of this book, when the reviews start coming out from academics, because that's a slower process. The reviews from lay people so far seem to be pretty positive, but I'm sure that there's another shoe that needs to drop where certain linguists and anthropologists are going to just tear me to ribbons. They're going to be furious at this book. And the reason is going to be that I'm undermining what one of the main pillars is of arguing for the preservation of languages. And most of the world's languages can be argued to be on the verge of extinction. There are 6,000 languages now. There could be only 600 in the next 80, after about 80 years. That is scary. That worries me. I have written about it. And I thought about the fact that I need to make some sort of case for how language preservation can be defended if we can't have this Worfian notion. To the extent that I think that I am going to be called out by certain language preservation people on that basis, I think I need to have something to say, and I could imagine writing some more. It wouldn't be a whole book, but I could imagine showing up at some conferences, writing an article, where I made that case. So, if that response is virulent enough, then, as always, I will certainly come out fighting. But in general, the language hoax was a pause for me, because my main work is actually on language change and language contact around the world, and I'm still working on paradigms connected to that. But Worfianism has interested me for about the past 15 years for various reasons, one of which is that the new Worfian work is in itself so fascinating, but also because of the way the world seems to be picking up on it. And I just decided it was time for me to get that one out of my system. But, you know, I like a fight. And I also am very concerned with the world's languages, every bit as concerned as the people who are out there trying to preserve them. And so, yeah, I get the feeling this is not the end of Worfianism and me.
Well, I wish you success in your hopefully peaceful encounters with the language preservation people. But until we hear reports of those, just like I said, John McWhirter, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
I've been talking to John McWhirter about the language hoax. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language saying thank you for listening.